So thank you very much for inviting me here to the Perimeter Institute for my first visit ever here. It's quite an impressive facility. It has many more fireplaces per capita than the one I work at. Infinitely many, in fact. And so it's been a pleasure to be here and talk with people too, and I look forward to a day and a half more of discussions. And also thank you for this very nice pointer. I'm actually left-handed, but I'll try to do the best I can with it. So I wanted to talk about some work we've been doing dates back over several years. So I give you some review and also some new things. Most of the work, I'll spend some time reviewing things related, but broader than some work I did with Svi Byrne and Volodya Smirnov about 3 years ago. And then now I'm in a larger collaboration, actually without Volodya, but with everyone else here, on working out a particular calculation. And I'll give you some preliminary results, which will come out later. Oh, that's the other thing about these big experimental collaborations, is we announce preliminary results for a few years before the final published values are available. OK. So as most of you know, probably all of you, N equals 4 Super-Yang-Mills theory is a very interesting testing bed in gauge theory, and also has very interesting links to phenomena in string theory. Because first of all, it's the most supersymmetric gauge theory you can write down without introducing gravity, because the 4 supersymmetries take you all the way from the sort of +1 component of the gluon down to the -1 component. So to have more than supersymmetries than that, you would have to introduce higher spin fields. And besides the gluon, it has 4 massless spin ½ gluinos, 6 massless spin zero scalars, all in the adjoint representation of the gauge group and all linked by N equals 4 supersymmetry. And because it's all in one multiplet, the supersymmetry is so powerful that it completely specifies all the interactions once you say what the gauge group is. And we're going to consider the gauge group to be SUNC with a very large number of colors, NC very large, the so-called planar limit. So there's one coupling, because all the interactions are uniquely determined in terms of that coupling. And it's an exactly scale invariant or conformal field theory. The beta function vanishes for all values of the coupling. So in this planar limit, then the ADS-CFT duality states that if we consider this from the perturbative point of view, you might expect something simple to happen in the limit that you try to sum up the whole perturbation series and go out the strong coupling. And that's because this large coupling limit should be equivalent to a weakly coupled gravity / string theory. Maybe you can describe it all in terms of a supergravity theory on ADS5 cross S5, or maybe you need to introduce some string states, for example, rotating strings moving in a weakly coupled background. And the TUF parameter is usually used in these limits. Lambda g squared is equal to g squared nc. So in one picture, ADS-CFT sort of looks like this. And many of you actually know what it looks like better than I do. But the idea is that we're going to have a scattering of gluons taking place in the arena, which is Minkowski space with one time and three space dimensions. But because of this duality, there's a secret interpretation of these gluon scattering amplitudes in terms of a space with one more coordinate, holographic coordinate, R. And this R sort of labels, from the point of view of Minkowski space gluon scattering, what kind of distance scales we're probing. When we're in a region of the collision where the gluons are right on top of each other, right during the collision, the ultraviolet regime corresponding to small states, that's the R goes to infinity limit. And smaller values of R will be the infrared state regime, which is associated with what happens before you quite get into the collision, while the states are sort of asymptotic, early in or late outgoing. Yeah. Yeah. It's not a stupid question. So it's on the question, it's two transparencies away under some questions you might have. No. Yeah. So yeah, it's very advanced. It's two transparencies ahead. If you don't mind, I'll answer it then. And if you're still unhappy, you can ask it again. So yeah. So now let's talk about gluon scattering. But before we do, let's say in advance that there are other quantities like correlators or anomalous dimensions of, for example, protected operators, in which we can sort of do this extrapolation from weak coupling to strong coupling very simply, because they're often not renormalized. And you look at the anomalous dimension, and it's a number at weak coupling. And you go look at it at strong coupling, and it's the same number. And so the function of lambda that you need is just a constant. But these 2 goes to 2 gluon scattering amplitudes are not protected like this. They get non-trivial perturbative corrections. And the question we tried to pose several years ago is, how does the series that you get for these scattering amplitudes organize itself into a simple result from the point of view of gravity and string theory? And another thing that started to crop up is the fact that contained within these scattering amplitudes, controlling some of their infrared divergences, is a quantity called the cusp anomalous dimension. And I'll say a little about that later. But it's actually a new non-trivial example, which seems to have been solved to all orders in lambda using integrability. So it's a non-trivial function of lambda for which there's a proposal which looks very good that interpolates between weak coupling and strong coupling. And this was due to Beissert, Eden, and Staudacher a couple years ago. So I want to, in this talk, propose, and then we'll investigate how valid this proposal is, that we can describe scattering of gluons at the four-point level and maybe beyond in terms of just a few functions of the coupling, lambda. So normally, you could get arbitrarily complicated functions of the scattering angle. But we're going to claim that the scattering angle dependence is very simple. And you just need to determine certain functions. So this is a proposal we made a little while ago. And about a little less than a year ago, Aldai and Maldacena gave some striking confirmation of this proposal for the 2 goes to 2 scattering case by interpreting it on the ADS CFT side and giving a strong coupling version of that corresponded with what we were seeing develop from the weak coupling side. On the other hand, there's been a lot of recent activity casting possible doubt on this proposal for N gluons, in some cases where N is very large, and more specifically for N of around 6. So we'll talk about that later. But here's the question that was already asked, sort of, let me rephrase it as, what are gluons? That is, ADS CFT most simply relates things like glue balls. By glue ball, I mean a color singlet gauge invariant local operator, like a trace of gluon times gluon, or multiple of gluons, or other states in the N equals 4 super Yang Mills. In contrast, what we want to talk about here are modes of the gauge fields that are color non-singlet. A gluon is, well, it's an octet it's in the adjoint representation. It's not a color singlet. So they're kind of harder to picture at very strong coupling. And then another question is, what does scattering mean for colored objects? Because as they try to make it out of the scattering process, if it's a conformal theory, and there are any interactions in here, there better be the same interactions out here. So how can you define an S matrix? Scattering amplitude doesn't seem to shut off. Another question I'll get to is, what is the cusp anomalous dimension? And what are the other functions of lambda that enter the amplitude? And also, what's the evidence for this proposal? But first, I wanted to go to the question you asked, which is that we're going to try to make this definition taking a cue from what people do all the time in perturbative QCD. So there's this LHC turning on soon. And it's basically colliding gluons together all the time. Now it's colliding them not in N equals 4 super Yang Mills, unless we're very surprised, but in QCD. And so it's sort of the same situation. You have these gluons coming in and going out, and the soft interactions between them never really turn off because they're colored, they interact through long wavelength gluons. Actually, it's worse. It's logarithmically worse because the coupling constant gets logarithmically large as you go out. So what we do in QCD is we just use dimensional regularization. We shift the dimension slightly away from 4 to 4 minus 2 epsilon, and that regulates the infrared divergences. As we take epsilon back to 0, we develop poles in epsilon. And so we actually systematically cancel those poles or take them into account in trying to construct an observable. So we're going to do something slightly different here. In that case, the poles end up canceling against real emission. There is this famous Kinoshita-Lee-Naunberg cancellation of infrared divergences in QED, where you, if you try to define the probability of electron-electron scattering, you can't do it because every electron is in, comes with a cloud of very soft photons. So you have to define an electron as something with some cloud of photons going on. So we're not actually going to try to do something that sophisticated here. We're just going to assert that the information about the important information about the conformal field theory can still be accessed by doing this Laurent expansion around epsilon equals 0, and then we'll see things developing at order epsilon to the 0, the finite remainders, which represent the scattering back in the conformal theory after we've removed the infrared divergences.
Is there any connection between using the way you use dimensional regularization here and regularizations you'll have to do at strong coupling in ADS-CFT?
So the thing is that Aldai and Maldacena were able to define a dimensionally regularized version of ADS-CFT so that they could make contact with how we did it. There are other ways to do it in principle. You could imagine regulating the divergences in a way that will also break conformal invariance, because these the gauge theory is a stack of brains, right? So suppose you start to separate the stacks. Then you introduce a mass scale associated with the separation, and you can regulate divergences in that way. But technically, it's harder to obtain the weak coupling results. Nobody's really done it past one loop. So that's why we're going to stick with this dimensional regulator. And in fact, what Alde and Maldacena did, as I'll describe in more detail later, as time permits, is that they discovered these gluons by attaching, I mean, I'm not sure if they're the first to discover them, but they used this interpretation to do the scattering from the strong coupling point of view by sort of tying open string ends to a D-brain in the IR down at the bottom of that picture. And then when you collide them with large S and T in the four-dimensional kinematics, that forces the strings to go into the UV to stretch a long ways. The kinematics forces that to happen. And so you see these gluons as having a large string attached to them as they try to get in from the IR into the collision. And they gave both a version regulated in that way, but then also a dimensionally regularized version of the same setup. So now let's go back to perturbation theory and ask, sort of, what is the structure of these infrared divergences as regulated by dimensional regularization? And at one loop, there are two types of infrared divergences. This is a picture that is like a more like a soft divergence. So you have a scattering process, and you have two hard lines coming out. And before they emerge, they exchange a soft gluon with virtual energy omega. And the kind of integral you have to do turns out to be d omega over omega. And as omega goes to 0, that diverges. But when you shift the dimension to 4 minus 2 epsilon, it looks something like this. And that gets regularized and gives you a 1 over epsilon pole. But there are also regions of this sort of momentum integration where the momentum isn't all that soft, but it's almost parallel to this massless line. And the transverse momentum, or the difference of the virtual momentum from the massless line, also gives rise to a divergence, which is logarithmic. It's regulated in the same way, and it gives another 1 over epsilon pole. So in contrast to UV divergences, where you get 1 power of 1 over epsilon at each loop, here you get 2 powers, because it's 2 separate regions of the integration, which kind of overlap, because you could be soft and collinear. These could both be small. So together, you get 1 over epsilon squareds at each loop. Now imagine going to L loops. There are many different singular regions, but the one that gives the biggest powers is where you nest all of these integrations. So the outer one is the most soft and most collinear. The inner one is a little less soft and a little less collinear, but all hierarchically separated. And then you can just run this argument through, and you pick up powers of 1 over epsilon squared from each successive integration. So you get 1 over epsilon of the 2L at L loops. In fact, there's been very sophisticated studies of this in the QCD context, which we can just steal and simplify to our to our applications. And the final answer is that in the planar limit for both QCD and n equals 4 super Yang Mills, the pole terms and the amplitudes can be expressed to all orders in perturbation theory in terms of 3 functions. First of all, the beta function, because you have to know how the coupling is running as you change the scale to know how the strength of these poles are changing. And we don't actually know it to all orders in QCD, but we do know it to all orders in n equals 4 super Yang Mills, and it's 0, so we don't have to worry about it for this context. There's also the cusp or soft anomalous dimension, which I promised to define later. And there's another one called a collinear anomalous dimension. So let's go to work on those. The cusp anomalous dimension, well, was given this name because it can be computed from an operator definition, where you take a Wilson line or path-ordered exponential along a contour that looks like this. And because of this kink or cusp in here, there's a non-trivial dependence of this on the renormalization scale through the beta function. And the coefficient of the term that goes logarithmically with this angle. This angle actually gets very large as these guys become light-like, which is the configuration we're interested in. This is the cusp anomalous dimension. It actually has many other definitions. For example, it controls, if you're a QCD phenomenologist, you would think of it in terms of, I'll get to that in a second. There are some anomalous dimensions for operators with very high spin. So these could be quarks, they could, in QCD. In n equals 4 super Yang Mills theory, they might be scalars, gluinos, or gluons. You could make a similar definition for them, where you've inserted many powers of the spin in four-dimensional space-time. And these operators have a logarithmically divergent behavior with the spin. They're anomalous dimensions. And the coefficient of this is, again, the cusp anomalous dimension. And then if you're a QCD phenomenologist, you talk about how partons inside the proton evolve with x. And the x goes to 1 limit of these splitting functions has a universal behavior, which is controlled by this cusp anomalous dimension. These two are actually very simply related, because these gamma j's are related by doing an integral called a Mellin transformation from the x space that QCD people are used to. So, but because of this, these quantities actually are quite interesting, of interest phenomenologically in things like LHC physics, where you may have to sum up the effects of many soft gluons. Okay, so there's been I mentioned that there's been a lot of analysis of these divergences in QCD. And here I'm going to follow the notation of Manier and Sturman, and Sturman and Tejeda-Yeomans. And they, in their notation, the idea, or in graphical pictures, first of all, here's the idea. We have a matrix element. We're going to think of it as being in d equals 4 minus 2 epsilon dimensions. We imagine that there's a hard core to this, which is similar to this matrix element, and then it has the same number of outgoing partons. But but we imagine that they're slightly off shell. They haven't really emerged completely from the scattering process. And so this hard function will be finite as epsilon goes to zero. It'll be well defined in that limit. But the full matrix element is not finite. And that's because two things happen as these partons come out. First of all, they can split collinearly. So there are collinear divergences. But somehow these are all confined to something called a jet function, because it resembles actual jets in hadron collisions, collimated particles. And those jets don't really talk to each other much. The only way they can talk to each other at large distances is through soft gluons, because those are the things that sort of see large distances. And those soft gluons here, S, in principle, they can talk to every single jet. But all they can see about this jet is its overall color, because they don't have the wavelength to resolve inside the jet and see what it's made out of. And so that's the heuristic justification for this picture, where we write this matrix element as a product of jet functions, hard and soft. So the soft function, in a general theory, is a complicated dependence on the colors of the particles, because the gluons carry color, and they can mix up all the colors of all the jets. The jet function is color diagonal, or the color non-diagonal pieces can be put into the soft function. It, in general, could depend on what kind of particle is going out. But there's a big simplification when we go to the planar limit, because now this soft function can't connect arbitrary lines. If it tries to go from here over to here, that requires a non-planar contribution. So we can break up the soft function into pieces which only connect neighboring hard lines. And in fact, the soft function is only defined up to multiples of the identity matrix. You can shuffle things between soft and jet. And in the planar limit, because it's really color trivial, you can put all of the soft stuff into these corresponding jets. That is, you can define everything in terms of thinking of this product as a wet product of pizza wedges. So here I've outlined one of the pizza wedges. And each wedge sort of has similar infrared behavior. So you can write the full matrix element, again, as a hard function dressed by stuff. And the stuff is the combinations of soft and half of each jet. And that wedge is also the square root of the two-point problem, right? If you do a pizza with two slices, then the product of the two slices is the whole pizza. And that's called the form factor, the Surikov form factor, for a single color singlet source having two gluons going out. So we can rewrite it in the planar limit. There's no color anymore. It's all black and white. And you get the product of n wedges, where each wedge is the square root of the two-point problem. So all the divergences are reduced to the problem of this so-called Surikov form factor. And actually, I should have put Surikov here, because he considered this first in the 1950s for QED. And then it was considered in QCD in a number of papers. And an evolution equation was written down for this form factor, because it only depends now on one scale. If you go back here, this thing depends on the scale. That is, it depends on the momentum invariant between these two adjacent partons. But because there's only one scale, dimensionful scale in the process, besides the renormalization scale, there's a very simple dependence on Q squared that follows from renormalization group arguments. And you get an equation, I won't go through the details, but it depends on two functions. One of them is called K. And this guy, you may be familiar with the theta function for the coupling, can be defined in away from four dimensions. And it's a pure counter term, the beta function. And this K is also a pure counter term. It's just a series of 1 over epsilon poles. And like the beta function, the single poles in epsilon at each order determine this function completely. One really means, it means an injection of momentum, so that you can have some say, time-like momentum, energy, but no space-like momentum, and then it decays to two gluons. We imagine as a test process for doing this, a Higgs boson decaying to two gluons through a virtual top quark loop. That's one example. Since we're talking about the infrared divergences, it doesn't really matter too much how we make these two gluons, but we just need to have some source of energy momentum that isn't colored. So this thing has some poles in it, and this term is finite as epsilon goes to zero, although when you integrate the differential equation, you get poles from this function g, and it contains the q squared dependence. And these two functions obey some differential equations. And so they're completely specified, and the most important thing is that this k function, its evolution is controlled by this cusp anomalous dimension. So this thing crops up in the evolution equation, and then there's going to be an integration constant for determining this finite g at one point, and those are going to be the two quantities, and then plus the beta function in QCD, three quantities that would determine the infrared poles for a general gauge theory. So it turns out it's really easy to solve the differential equations for k and g in the case of a conformal theory because the coupling doesn't run. And it's just controlled by its engineering dimension in 4 minus 2 epsilon dimensions. It has a trivial behavior. When you solve them and you insert this result back into this Sudikoff form factor and then insert the Sudikoff factor into the endpoint amplitude, this is the expression that you get. There are these two series of constants, one for the cusp anomalous dimension and one for the integration constant for g, which I'll call gamma k hat and g zero hat, just because the hats just mean I've pulled out powers of nc along with powers of the coupling g squared over 4 pi. And so the new expansion parameter I call a is pretty closely related to lambda. There are some nagging factors of the Euler-Mascheroni constant, et cetera, here. But it's basically related to lambda. And so you actually get double poles associated with the cusp anomalous dimension, and single poles associated with g inside the exponential. So if you expand out the exponential, you'll get those epsilon to the 2L at the elf loop order from in here, as promised. And then these get weighted by the appropriate invariant, and then there's a sum over the different invariants. So remarkably, this thing, well, not so remarkably, because the same analysis applies at one loop, but this thing in here looks like the one loop amplitude. The only difference is it's gotten shifted to L epsilon. So we're going to try to write a formula for it, for the amplitude, in terms of the one loop amplitude at L epsilon. And we have to write some function of epsilon in front. And the first term, and this is going to be a three-term expansion in epsilon. The first term in the expansion, when we compare to here, has to be this cusp anomalous dimension, because that comes with certain 1 over epsilon squared terms. The next term of order epsilon lines up with here, and so we identify it with this g0 hat function. And this one actually multiplies some finite terms. So we could have put it in the hard function, but we'll leave it there for the second, for a minute. So here's that formula again. And what we want to propose, because we saw this happening in some simple examples, is that this hard function might be a series of constants. And our original proposal was it could be a series of constants for a certain class of scattering amplitudes, where two of the gluons have negative helicity and the rest have positive helicity. Those are called MHV amplitudes. So the proposal is that for some amplitudes, maybe this is a constant. And if you take the implications of this for the four-point amplitude, where this one-loop amplitude is very well known, you find that the finite part of the one-loop amplitude to all orders should look like the cusp anomalous dimension times the log squared of S over T. So what's the evidence for this proposal? So it first came out of studying two-loop amplitudes, the four-point amplitude and later the five-point amplitude, And also, we earlier had an argument based on some collinear limits I'll go through later. And then there was some more evidence at three loops for the four-point amplitude. And then there was some strong coupling evidence introduced by Aldai and Malbacena last year. And just to point out that if you try to do the same thing in, say, planar QCD, these hard functions would definitely not be constants. They would be complicated combinations of tetralogarithms and other functions. So there's something special going on in n equals 4 super Yang mills. And in fact, nothing simple seems to happen in the non-planar subleading color terms for n equals 4 super Yang mills. So it seems to be special to planar n equals 4 super Yang mills. And the way some of this evidence was collected was by building amplitudes up using perturbative unitarity as a guide. So if you take the loop expansion, or expansion in the couplings, and represent the sum of all diagrams by blobs with the number of holes equal to the number of loops, then you can insert this expansion into the unitarity relation, and you get cutting rules, and which say that the discontinuities in different channels of these multi-loop amplitudes can be reduced to integrals over intermediate phase space of lower loop amplitudes. And you can try to match that. So you can find representations of the amplitudes that match all of the cuts. And this turns out to be very efficient for this, especially for n equals 4 super Yang mills, because they're very simple structures and lots of on-shell identities that let you relate the different tree amplitudes you need to insert into the cuts. There's also a generalized version of unitarity, which apparently was discovered a long time ago. That is, if one cut is good, more cuts must be better. It was sort of discovered by the shaving industry a little bit after it was discovered in agriculture. And indeed, back in the 60s, there were multiple cut conditions that were, their analysis was discussed, connected with leading singularities by collected in a book called The Analytic S Matrix. And then at one loop, it was recognized that you could efficiently extract coefficients of triangles, triangle integrals, and especially box integrals, which is work that Freddie did with Ruth Brito and Bo Feng in identifying quadruple cuts, which really collapse the problem down to algebra. And you can do similar things at the multi-loop level. And so we use this technique to build up representations of four, and other people did five loop amplitudes. And it may not be, well, but so just for example, when you consider the four-point amplitude at three loops, then you have to do it. One of the things you'd like to analyze is this three-particle cut, which has a five-point tree multiplied by a 5.1 loop amplitude. But you'd rather not work with this one loop amplitude directly because it's kind of complicated. So you can further cut it by requiring that more propagators are open. And you can cut it in different ways. And so all the information in here is really captured in these different products of tree amplitudes multiplied together for suitable intermediate kinematics. So we used sort of graphs like this to build up representations for the loop amplitudes. And they turn out to be quite simple. The one loop amplitude for n equals 4 in the planar limit has a single box diagram where this represents an integral which is just a product of scalar propagators, 1 over p squareds. There's no numerator factors in here. They all factor out into a product of the Mandelstam invariant in the S channel, in the T channel, and then the tree amplitude. When you go to two loops, you get just as simple an answer, really. You get the same prefactor, and you get the planar double box appearing in both orientations with one extra factor of S or T. When you go to three loops, now finally you have a second integral appearing. Besides the triple ladder diagram, you get this so-called tennis court diagram, or half a tennis court, or something. In this case, there's a numerator factor that depends on the loop momentum, L, going around one of the legs. But still, for considering the thousands of Feynman diagrams here, the fact that it collapses to just two integrals is pretty remarkable. At four loops, you get a total of 8 different integrals that you have to do. And many of them start to have powers of the loop momenta inserted. And when you go to 5 loops, you get, 34 of them here. So one question you might have is, where did these things come from? They seem to have a lot of interesting patterns in them. Are there some ways of codifying the patterns? And there is one thing you can say. Well, what we said originally is we tried to, at the for loop case, we tried to understand what sorts of integrals you could get. And the first thing we said sort of primitively is let's assume there aren't any triangle subdiagrams, because we don't see them at one loop. And if they were there at multi-loops, we could imagine drawing circles around the triangles and reducing it to the one loop case. But that's sort of not sufficient, because if you just say there are no triangles, then you get 16 or something, 17 integrals that would be allowed but don't show up in the answer. So why don't these topologies appear? And what distinguishes them from the ones that do appear? So Drummond, Henn, Smirnoff, and Sokachev made an interesting observation, which is that the integrals that appear can be distinguished by the fact that they have something called dual conformal invariants. So let me define what that means. So actually, you know that conformal invariance involves an inversion of something. So let's invert something. What are we going to invert? Well, we can't invert the momenta themselves because they have ki squared equals 0. So we better not invert them. Furthermore, even if we took the ki squareds to be non-zero, we wouldn't be able to maintain momentum conservation. So the idea is to introduce dual variables, sometimes called sector variables, which are not the momenta, but they live in these wedges, which are defined if you continue these momenta all the way out. So, and there's a difference relation between the dual momenta and the actual momenta. So K1 is the difference of X4 and X1, of these two X variables. So the X variables themselves aren't exactly defined. They're just defined through the fact that their differences give the K variables. But that's enough to make sense out of everything. And the fact that there's this differencing means it is permissible to invert the X's without destroying momentum conservation, because momentum conservation is automatic in the fact that they in the way these are defined. If I add up K1 to K4, because they're defined through differences, I automatically get 0, which is momentum conservation. So let's take these X's and invert them and require that the answer, if we could evaluate it in four dimensions, is invariant. And so inverting the measure puts a factor of 1 over xi to the 8th, or xi squared to the 4th downstairs. And you can work it out. The difference of two x's gives you xij back squared divided by these factors. And so if you think about it, oh, I forgot to say, there are also dual variables associated for each loop momentum that's being integrated over. So the red graph is the sort of original graph you would have drawn. And then this is a dual graph that connects all the dual vertices. And so it's dual in the usual graph notation sense that you have lines that intersect lines. And points go to faces, and faces go to points, sort of. And then each line here, each solid line, corresponds to a propagator. So that this propagator here is 1 over x1 squared, 1 over x51 squared, 1 over x52 squared, 1 over x54 squared, and 1 over x56 squared. Since there are four propagators, and each one has a x that have a 5 in it. When I do this inversion, I pick up 4 powers of x5 squared, and that cancels the 4 powers coming from the measure. So boxes are very happy from the point of view of this inversion, because if you put a box in and don't put any loop momentum in the numerator, then it will have this inversion symmetry. And so this box is also happy. And you can make the external legs happy quite easily by putting in powers of the external invariants. This one here had this x4 or x2 have 2 lines. And these only have 1. If you want to balance things out, you should multiply by something in the numerator denoted by a dotted line. And that runs from x4 to x2. So that x4 2 squared works out to be k1 plus k2 squared, or s, the momentum flowing this way. So this needs 1 power of s. And then if you want, you should have another power of s times t, which neutralizes the surviving 1 leg there. So that tells you how to address this integral to make it conformal invariant. So you address it by s squared times t. And that's exactly what was there in those two loop, in the representation of the 2 loop amplitude. Also, you're not allowed to put an xi minus 1 I squared, where these separate just by 1, because that would be k1 squared or k2 squared. And those things are going to 0 in the physical amplitude. So we won't allow those. So if you use those rules, then you find that you can draw these nice dual diagrams that represent the dual conformal invariants, say at 4 loops, for all the diagrams that were there in the amplitude. They all have these nice, pretty representations. And then all the ones that weren't present can be argued away. For example, there one of the ones that didn't have triangles but had 0 coefficient could be made dual conformal invariant, but only by inserting a power. You had to balance out this guy, say, with x3 4 squared, and that's k4 squared, which is 0 on shell. So you could rule out all those other guys. We actually, when we wrote our paper, there were 2 diagrams we couldn't explain away that look sort of like this one, but are dressed differently, and also this one. But Drummond, Korchemsky, and Sokachev pointed out that these ones aren't really regularized, even if you take these legs off shell. So they don't really have a sensible 4-dimensional interpretation. If you add that additional criterion, then you can explain everything that appears in terms of dual conformal invariants. And at 5 loops, you find that there were 59 diagrams that have this invariance. Only 34 are present in the amplitude. But Drummond, Korchemsky, and Sokachev could show that the other 25 could be ruled out by this finiteness criterion. So there's this sort of one-to-one correspondence between these finite dual conformal integrals and the quantities that you need to write down the planar amplitudes. So, and even also very interestingly, these integrals can only appear empirically with weight plus or minus 1. And I guess Freddie and David Skinner have been developing some interesting, more advanced multi-loop generalized unitarity techniques that can generate some of these numbers here. So it'll be very interesting to see how far this can all be pushed. Actually, if you were not interested in just planar graphs, then you might wonder whether you could do something similar, how this dual conformal invariance might extend to the non-planar case. But that seems to be an open question still. Well, I'll tell you, it's special to the 4-point case, because we've been doing some calculations now back at 2 loops, but for 5 and 6 point, especially 6-point amplitude, where we get 2s and 4s. So whatever you can explain about why it's plus or minus 1, you also have to explain why it's not in amplitudes with more legs, why it's not always plus or minus 1. Okay, so the way you have to, but what we really wanted to know is what's the expansion of these amplitudes around 4 dimensions. At this point, you have to do some integrals. And just to indicate what you need to do at three loops, for example, you want to test whether this three loop amplitude is really an exponential up to a constant, which appears at order epsilon to the zero, of these lower loop amplitudes. And if you expand out this exponential and collect powers of the coupling and go to the three loop order, it says that you, to find this constant, you first have to subtract this combination of lower loop amplitudes. And one of the things it has in it is the one loop amplitude Q. So you need to know the one loop amplitude, that is the one loop box integral, all the way up to epsilon to the fourth, because it's getting multiplied by two other powers of it, each starting at 1 over epsilon squared. And so you get 1 over epsilon to the fourth for two of them, you'll need up to epsilon to the fourth in the third factor. Fortunately, this integral is elementary. When you go to the two loop amplitudes, you need to expand them up through epsilon squared, because they get multiplied by a one loop amplitude that has a 1 over epsilon squared. And then the three loop integrals, for this problem, you just need them to order epsilon to zero. Fortunately, there's a Mellon-Barnes integration method that you can use to do all of these integrals. And Smirnov sort of pioneered this application and did this triple ladder earlier. So when you insert the values of the integrals, you find that this is indeed a constant. And you can extract some of these constants at the three loop level. This F0 of three loop is the three loop cusp anomalous dimension. That was actually computed by, in the QCD context, by Mach, Vermaseren, and Vogt in a very heroic calculation. And then there was a principle of maximum transcendentality applied to predict it for the n equals 4 Supriang-Mills result. And that worked. And then the next term in the expansion is the three loop value of this g function in n equals 4 Supriang-Mills. And that was predicted and confirmed a month later by Mach, Vermaseren, and Vogt, again using this some mysterious principle I'm not going to get into here. And then finally, at the finite order, you get some finite remainder. You can't actually separate this constant c from the third term in this f function. In order to do that, you need to have a five-point amplitude. But I was mentioning earlier that this cusp anomalous dimension is known to all orders, at least if you believe this proposal of Beissert, Eden, and Staudacher, which was based on integrability and backed up by a lot of finite numbers. So their proposal is actually represented, can be evaluated numerically. That's what these X's show, using work by Benna, Benvenuti, Plevanoff, and Scardicchio. And what it, and the proposal agrees analytically at on the weak coupling side through four loops. That was a four loop cusp anomalous dimension was computed by us, and then with higher accuracy by Freddie, Mark Spradlin, and Anastasia Volovich, and agrees incredibly well with the proposal. And then out at strong coupling, this proposal also agrees with the first three terms in the strong coupling expansion, which were computed by Gubser, Kovanoff, and Polyakov, Fulop, and Seitlin, and then the third term last year by Roybon and Seitlin. So there's these sort of seven pieces of data that this proposal agrees with. So it looks pretty likely to be correct. And as I said, it's one of them, these three functions that you would need for the four-point amplitude, and maybe a fourth one for the five-point amplitude. This function G0 is not quite as well known, I'd say, but it's getting there. The Freddie, Mark, and Anastasia computed it at four loops. It comes out of the same set of integrals I showed you for the four-point amplitude, but they had to expand them to one higher power in epsilon, and they got this numerical value. And then they also had not three pieces of data out here, but only one piece of data, the strong coupling limit from the work of Alda and Maldacena, which I haven't quite explained yet. And they could build this approximation to it based on a PaDe that incorporates all the data. So that's the best we know about G0. And there's no proposal yet for an exact solution for it. Since I'm running late, I'm going to skip the details of this. But the 5-point amplitude at 2 loops has also been directly verified to be in agreement with this proposal through some work by Freddy and Anastasia and Mark, and then later by Vernon collaborators. We also looked at the collinear limits as two momenta become parallel, because they're very important constraints on amplitudes. And in fact, we originally saw that this exponentiation was appearing in the guise of these collinear limits. So when two legs get collinear for a tree amplitude, the amplitude factorizes into the product of an amplitude with one less leg, because this is almost on shell, times some splitting amplitude that's a function of these momentum fractions of A and B, and also on the helicities. And at one loop, you get similar behavior, except that you can have lower point, one loop, and tree amplitudes. And so you need a new function, the one loop splitting amplitude, to make this picture consistent. And then finally, the same thing happens at the two loop level. So we computed these two loop splitting amplitudes, and we saw that they obeyed a very similar relation to this iteration, amplitude iteration. In fact, we found this first, that the two loop splitting amplitude, well, I've factored out this tree level splitting amplitude, but this two loop quantity was 1/2 of the one loop quantity plus this extra piece here. And that is a consistency condition that's sufficient, necessary, but not necessarily sufficient for this two loop relation to hold. It also helps you separate the F2 constant and the C2 constant. In any case, so we have these collinear limits that are consistent with the behavior at two loops. Now, what's happened more recently is people have looked at other consistency relations. So another thing you can do is to go into various high energy limits. And this has been studied by Nasulich and Schnitzer, Brouwer, Nastasi, Schnitzer, and Tan, Bartels, Lipitoff, and Sabio Vera. And they found that everything was consistent with known or highly likely factorization properties in this limit, known as Regi or BFKL factorization, for the cases of 4 and 5 gluons. But in the 6 gluon case, the situation has been kind of murky. BNST, their current version, finds consistency with the 6, 7, 8 gluons. But this other paper by Bartels, Lipatov, and Sabio Vera claims an inconsistency. And they've looked at it in a little bit closer detail. But we'll have to see how that works out. But in principle, you can definitely test the consistency of this by going into various kinematic limits. So I need to mention briefly what Alde and Maldacena actually did. Here's a picture of them scattering two gluons together by representing the gluons as these strings at D-brain, anchored to D-brains, which are coming in very fast this way. And so in the interior, this coordinate Z, which is basically 1 over R, has to be stretched up this direction. And they argue that because it's stretched a long ways, there is a semi-classical limit where the most important thing in the strong coupling limit is a classical action, which is imaginary or in the Euclidean region. So it leads to a very damped exponential. So this damping is known as Sudikoff suppression. If you try to get something colored out of a hard process, it's very hard to do it because it can keep radiating soft gluons. So it's exponentially hard. And if the coupling is large, it's really hard because the coefficient in the exponential is very large. So it's better. So this was their picture with this regulator, but then they went back and did it in dimensional regularization. And they introduced some also dual variables, which are really the same as these dual variables I mentioned before. That is, the difference between two x's, in this case, is the vector going from here to here. And that is a light-like distance, which is the momentum of the gluon k1. And similarly, k2 is that vector, k3 that one. So you form a closed loop, which is kind of oscillating up and down because of the choice of incoming, outgoing for the kinematics. So the those are the boundary values for the world sheet at in the asymptotic region. And then you minimize the area of the world sheet in order to find the classical solution. And again, these corners here are sort of in between the asymptotic momenta, so they correspond to these pizza wedges. And you can see that this dual conformal invariance is creeping in through these dual variables. In fact, near each corner, the solution looks like a cusp. When you get close enough to it, you don't know what the rest of the process is doing. And the cusp solution was found earlier by Kuchensky. And it was found to diverge, and the coefficient of the divergence is exactly the strong coupling limit of this cusp anomalous dimension. And so this is in this configuration of Alde and Maldacena, each corner here corresponds exactly to one of these pizza wedges from the perturbative point of view. It's the strong coupling limit of it. And this is pointed out by Buchbinder. So the full solution turned out for the four-point case to be a sort of simple matching of the cusp. And the higher point cases have been a lot harder to work out. But in the four-point case, the exponential of the classical action has this form from Aldai and Maldacena. And the 1 over epsilon squared pole term can be identified precisely with gamma k of lambda. The next term, the 1 over epsilon pole, can be identified with g0 of lambda, and that was the large coupling information used to construct the Pade approximate for this function. And then this is consistent with what we were saying, that the finite part of A4 should be proportional to the cusp anomalous dimension multiplied by the kinematic property of the one loop amplitude. The inspired by the relevance of these dual variables in the work of Aldai and Maldacena, and the fact that what looks like what you're doing is a Wilson line calculation, there have been a lot of recent Wilson line calculations in gauge theory and perturbative n equals 4 super Yang mills. So you use the same configurations that Aldai and Maldacena used, where each vector is a difference of represents a sort of each corner is where the momenta are located, the external momenta. And these are path ordered exponentials, and then you at one loop have graphs like this, which can connect neighboring lines or they can connect across. So Drummond, Korchemsky, and Sokachev pointed out that this has the exact same form up to constants as the one loop answer for these one loop gluon scattering amplitudes. And then one loop any n was worked out by Brandhuber, Heslop, and Travellini a little while ago. And then work began at the two loop case by this Drummond, Hen, Korchemsky, and Sokachev. So they worked on the 4 and 5 point cases at two loops, which include Wilson line configurations like this. And in all such cases, the Wilson line results match the full scattering amplitude at one loop. So at one loop, these have been computed for n greater than 5. And then what they match is the MHV case. So you could say, in all cases, they match the MHV case. These guys also pointed out that the Wilson lines obey a dual conformal Ward identity. So these integrals are built out of, the answer is built out of these dual conformal integrals. But I have to say, it's a little bit of a heuristic thing, because you can't make sense out of it unless you sort of are continuing away from four dimensions. So there's a more precise question you can ask about the expansion of the full amplitude, or the Wilson line, in epsilon. And that also seems to obey the same kind of identity you would get based on this inversion symmetry and generating the special conformal generators. So that identity, you can argue, it totally fixes the structure of the Wilson lines for n equals 4 and 5 up to constants. But at n equals 6, that's not true anymore. You know that in ordinary conformal field theory, you start to get cross ratios, which are invariant under conformal transformations. The reason this only happens at n equals 6 is because of this criterion that we're not allowed to use these xi I plus 1 squares. So with this constraint, cross ratios first come up in the 6-point case, where you can build things like x13 squared, x46 squared over x14 squared, x36 squared. So there are three of those cross ratios in the 6-point problem. So Drummond, Hen, Korchemsky, and Sokachev computed the two-loop Wilson line for n equals 6, and they found a discrepancy with this proposal of ours that it works, that you could predict the two-loop amplitude up to constants. And so they have some function here which represents the difference between the prediction and the true result. And you can see, I didn't tell you what this variable is, but it's not a constant. So then we asked, what does this mean for amplitudes? And so this is this work that we're finishing up now for the two-loop, 6-point scattering amplitude. So it's the scattering analog of the calculation that Drummond, Korchemsky, and Sokachev and Korchemsky did just last December. And I'll just show you some of the types of integrals that appear. At one loop, you get boxes. You also get certain pentagons that only inhabit certain odd terms that have Levitch-Civita tensors that we're going to ignore, actually, in this case. We're just going to look at these even terms. And this one looks kind of weird. It has an extra-dimensional component of the loop momenta. And somehow that makes this integral be in 6 dimensions, effectively. And so you can kind of make sense out of it in a dual conformal diagram with 6 spokes coming out. But in any case, when you go to the two-loop level, you get about 15 or 16 integrals. And many of them don't have any loop momenta in the numerator, but several of them do. They all sort of obey this dual conformal invariance rule. But sometimes you get plus or minus 1s, plus or minus 2s, and plus, one case, a plus or minus 4, plus or minus because I can't remember the sign. And you also get extra terms that have these extra powers of the loop momentum. So the status is that this expression passes many consistency checks. We've checked most of the cuts in D dimensions, although not every single one. And when we expand it out in epsilon, all the poles are exactly what are expected from the infrared structure. And this order epsilon of 0 finite term, we can only evaluate numerically, but we can tell that this original ansatz doesn't work. And it also has this dual conformal invariance property that Drummond, Hen, Korchemsky, and Sokachev found for the Wilson lines. But most remarkably is that this remainder function for the amplitude agrees numerically with the corresponding one for the Wilson line. So we can evaluate this in various random kinematic points, k1 to k5, with different random values for this conformal ratios. And we actually look at the remainder function and subtract off the remainder function at some reference point, and we get these numbers. And then in private communications, the DHKS sent us their values at the same points, and they all match up to our errors in integration, which are larger than theirs. So what this means is that at the six-point level, where there could, in principle, even if both things obey dual conformal invariance, there could be an arbitrary function of three variables that could be different between Wilson lines and these MHV scattering amplitudes. In fact, they're still the same. So it's kind of interesting. And I want to just stop then with some conclusions and a few open questions, of which there are quite a few. So these finite terms in planar gluon scattering amplitudes exponentiate through this evidence by Aldai and Maldacena, seems to confirm a proposal that we had. They exponentiate in a very similar way to these infrared divergences. And so the full amplitude seems to depend on just four functions of lambda, well, really three for the four-point case, and one more you would need for the five-point case. So you might consider this problem of the exact scattering amplitude to be one quarter solved, since you already know what one of the functions is, the cusp anomalous dimension. Of course, the other ones might be harder to solve. And a big question is, what is the ADS or operator interpretation of these other three functions? Can you pose the problem well enough that the people who are experts in integrability can figure out how to construct exact solutions for them? And then there's a whole bunch of ill-defined questions about exactly how all these different properties are related to each other. It's still not understood why these MHV scattering amplitudes should have this dual conformal invariance. It's not understood why MHV amplitudes should be equal to Wilson lines. There's a whole host of scattering amplitudes that you can construct in gauge theory that depend in an intricate way on what the polarization vectors are of the gluons. One configuration is MHV. Then there are other ones with equal numbers of pluses and minuses, which are much more complicated. The computation of Aldai and Maldacena seems to correspond for the 4- and 5-point case. Well, in that case, there really is only MHV. But the Wilson line calculations have been done now at the 6-point level. Why does it doesn't actually know anything about the polarizations of gluons. It's just computing expectation values of some contours. There are no gluon polarizations. Why does this line up with the MHV amplitudes? What is this remainder function? We both we have representations for it from our side and from the Wilson line side, but so far they're just numerical. So we'll try to work on getting an analytic formula for it, which might be necessary also to study some of these Regi limits and test consistency there. And then what happens for the non-MHV amplitudes? Is there any simple pattern that they obey? We already know from their structure at one loop that the answer has to be considerably more complex. So I think I've taken enough of your time, so thanks a lot.
Any questions?
Well, if there are no questions, let's thank the speaker again.